And I want to talk to you a little bit more about hunting with your dogs, but first, let me reintroduce you. If you're just tuning in, this is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. And our guests today are Christine Cunningham and Steve Meyer of Kenai. They're hunters and recreationists, and we're talking to them today about spending time outdoors and hunting on the Kenai Peninsula. So you kind of, you know, mentioned your dog and wanting to kind of follow your dog's lead or kind of adhere to your dog's judgment in during the hunt. Do you ever find that, you know, the objectives or direction that your dogs are taking when you're hunting is different from the direction you want to go? And kind of how do you manage that interplay between dog and human? And it seems like there could be some conflicts of interest there.
That's such a great question. Winchester, the one I just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. The show pony.
Yeah, the show pony. Well, when he was a pup, he was a hunter. I mean, he was literally hunting the parking lot in Anchorage when we got him off the plane. He came from North Dakota. But anyway, you know, we'd take him hunting, and I, not Christine, wouldn't do this, but I would say, well, we need to go here, and I'd make him go here. And it took a while to realize that, you know, what the hell are we thinking? We don't know what, this dog knows more about hunting than we'll ever know. So stop it. And I finally told myself, stop it. Let him take you places. And let him do what he does. And when we learn to do that, oh man, life got great, because he's not wrong. One time we were going up into a mountain pass, and I was having these awful chest pains. I didn't know what the hell was wrong, but I could hardly walk. But we were too far away for me to get help or anything, so it was either do or die. In the meantime, Winchester runs, and we measured this later with a GPS, 700 vertical feet, and goes on point. And we're looking, and I'm holding my chest, and I tell Christine, well, you've got to go honor his point, and because you can't, I mean, we know that he's right, and you can't let him do that and then tell him, no, we're not gonna go up there because it's too far.
Well you could,
but you can't. That's a rule, you can't. And so she has to go up there because I'm struggling just to stay alive, and finally whatever was going with me passed. But they got up there, Winchester's got birds on point, held for 45 minutes. He's standing like a statue. And so yeah, you get to where you, and you know what? Humans so often just want to control everything, and sometimes you got to just let it go. With a good hunting dog, just. And I remember when I was talking to the breeder when Winchester was about 6 months old, and I was talking to him, you know, what should I do? And he goes, why don't you just take him hunting and see how that works out for you? And boy, was he right. Just take him hunting.
Do you feel like hunting with other animals, with dogs, kind of brings you closer, brings you a more intimate connection with what you're doing and with nature?
I absolutely do. I think that is a really great question, and I've often thought that there's sort of dogs act as a medium between the wild and the domestic. So I mean, we as humans, we're not domestic, we're civilized, but dogs, it's kind of like they live in both worlds. They have this physical ability and all these heightened senses that we don't have that they can help us with and bring to the equation, and yet we can provide this sort of stability. And so a dog can expend itself like a wolf wouldn't, because a wolf, that wouldn't be efficient. But a dog can afford to run really wide for a bird because he knows you've got dinner and a, you know, cup full of whipped cream at the,
From the coffee shop.
From the coffee shop, waiting for him. So it's really great because you can sort of, we're bonded with our dogs, and you can sort of vicariously experience a little bit through them and your partners out there. It's a cool partnership.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody did they put a GoPro on a bird dog.
Oh, cool.
They were pheasant hunting, and this is one of the coolest YouTube videos we've ever seen. And this was like 5 or 6 years ago. We saw this, and then we both watched it. It was unbelievable how cool this was, seeing from the dog's point of view. And now we can't find it again, and we don't know what happened to it. But it was a great illustration of what a dog sees, you know, what they're doing and how they do it.
So it's so interesting to hear you guys talk about these different perspectives. And I imagine, Steve, hunting by yourself is really different from hunting with Christine and vice versa. And to kind of experience that on so many different levels sounds like, or to experience it through the lens of writing an outdoors column, right? And taking photos and having all those different. And something we had talked about before that I kind of want to ask you about is type 2 fun, or type B fun, as you put it. And you had mentioned earlier in that story, you know, climbing or crawling through the spiders and the muck. And how would you kind of characterize, how type 2 fun functions into the things that you do? And for folks who maybe haven't heard that phrase before, type 2 fun is when maybe you're not having a good time in the moment, but afterwards you feel pretty good about what you did. I mean, is that a big part of hunting and of your outdoor experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I think something happens though over time where I don't know if you become a masochist or what, but where type 2 fun actually is type 1 fun. So, but we had a little girl with us on a hike this past week, and she was definitely intrigued by this idea of type 2 fun, because she definitely knew that her adventure would be a great story, and that she had a big win by achieving, you know, by never giving up and not complaining and being a trooper. She knew that was going to be great and worth it, but the during it was not great. It was very hard, and it was just hold your breath till you get to the end. And that is exactly how I felt crawling through the marsh. Like, I'm just going to get through this. And I think over time, like now that I've been out in the field for over a decade, I'm actually don't want it to go too fast. Like, I want to slow it down and get even that sort of gritty, tough part is like the best part. And so you find yourself in that weird place where it's kind of flipped. You know, you lay in your warm bed at night going, gosh, I sure wish I was shivering in a sleeping bag at a camp somewhere.
Yeah, and you have a column about camping and about how it's kind of a suffer fest, but in a good way, which I thought was really funny. How has kind of hunting and recreating in this area changed, both with, you know, there being more people, and I know you also have a column about the Swan Lake fire changing the landscape. I mean, how have your experiences changed in the last, you know, couple decades for you, Steve, that you've been hunting, and, you know, maybe more recently since you started hunting, Christine?
Yeah, it seems like there's ebbs and flows with like the flats or certain mountain places. There's lots of special places that people hunt. Like, you hunt someplace and it kind of feels like it's yours because you have this connection to it. And then you see other people feel that way about it too. And it becomes a shared place. But, you know, I saw the flats go from, you know, being a small group of people that knew the place and knew each other to sort of having this like post-duck dynasty explosion of people who hadn't been out there ever before and didn't sort of know the unwritten code of conduct. And then, you know, that kind of taper off. And then with COVID, seems like there's been this renewed interest in the outdoors and more mixed uses and more people out there for the first time, maybe. So it's interesting to see how places change, and especially places that you love, you can sort of see the impacts of the people being there and that sort of thing. Is that what you're kind of looking for?
Yeah, and you mentioned mixed use. I mean, of course, with any sort of when you have any, you know, group of multiple users and people using things for different purposes, there's going to be some conflict, like, you know, with dog owners and trappers and in parts of Cooper Landing. There's a whole kind of conversation going on now about that. And, you know, do you ever kind of come across any of those tensions, or are there any points there that have ever, you know, concerned you in terms of interest groups and things like that?
I guess there's things I know about from knowing about them, and then my personal experiences, which have been overall pretty great. We have encountered other people that aren't hunting while we're hunting, and it's been interesting. Sometimes, I mean, you can get to a judgmental place. You're like, what the heck is that person doing? But so Steve might have a better answer than me. I think it's been pretty. My experience with that has been pretty pleasant, so I don't have any hot story of confrontation. Like, nobody shot at me.
Well,
I'm just kind of, you know, curious if, you know, as people with your own kind of diverse set of interests, like, you don't use the land for the same thing all the mm-hmm. time, if that's even within your own experience, like, you know.
You know, like Christine mentioned, you know, you get to where you develop relationships with certain places, and those, you know, that when no matter what the weather is, no matter what's going on, you still want to be there. But, you know, one of the things that we do as human beings is we take ownership in things that we love, and so that can get confusing, and the reality is public land is public land, and so, you know, everyone has a right to be in our special place if it's public land. And so, you know, it doesn't really do much good to be mad at somebody for showing up in your spot. And you know, with the more people out doors like we've seen in the last year, there's a lot more people outdoors, and I guess the only thing that I that concerns me at times is people kind of tend to be of a herd mentality, and they might enter these places without really and not maliciously, but the more you disturb a place, that can have an effect on that environment. And I think we're starting to see that in national parks and places like that, where you get so many people and so much human traffic that it changes everything for the animals that live there. And so, but that's, you know, I don't really know how you can't legislate that. I mean, you can try, but so I guess, you know, as far as conflict, not really. I accepted long ago that, you know, we're really fortunate to have the public land we have, and, you know, if that means sharing it with people, well, okay. But here's the other way to avoid that, and this is what Christine and I have always done, is just walk a little further. You'll solve the problem.
Right. We only have about 5 minutes left, so I want to kind of keep this last one quick, but this is something that I wanted to ask you about, is do you think there are any barriers to entry for folks who are kind of trying to get into this world, and do you have any kind of recommendations of how to, you know, overcome those?
I do. So if this world's just enjoying the outdoors, I think it is pretty easy to just go on a hike like you would go on a walk. You know, maybe you want to carry whatever protection you feel comfortable with, but you know, come as you are. I've seen people on a mountain in their pajamas or with a cup of espresso. So I love that about Alaska. But in terms of like, if you would want to do more that is sort of hunting or it requires a degree of skill in the outdoors, I can't say enough about the Becoming an Outdoor Woman program. I think it's really wonderful because it gives you access to people who know certain things that they can teach you. You can learn in an environment that's shared and make friends that you can then later go afield with and do things with. And you have this bit of support and go back for more, the different levels of what you can learn, starting out like a beginner hunter's ed course and then going into like, now I'm going to learn how to field dress an animal. Now I'm going to learn how to, cook this certain way or flesh or all these different things that are things you can keep growing your toolkit on that regard. But Steve might have something that's not so like, go to this workshop, but that's a really great idea.
Or I might not.
You might not.
I think, the world that we know now has in, not intentionally maybe, but there are barriers for folks. Probably the assumption by looking at what's on TV or what's in ads or, the outdoors has become very commercially driven. And, to look at all this stuff, people, I'm sure, think, well, I could never afford to do that. I can't afford those boots, or I can't afford that Gore-Tex jacket, or whatever it is. And the reality is, you don't need any of that. I mean, you can wake up and put the clothes on you put on every day and go walk up a mountain. You're not going to die. There's certain times when you have to use common sense. But I think that's a barrier. One of the most disturbing statistics I've seen in recent past is not only are we losing hunters, the demographic for people who are participating in hunting, people with who have very moderate to low incomes aren't hunting. And those are the people that should be hunting. Those are the people that should be, you'd like in a perfect world, yeah, if you can't afford meat, then you go hunt and get meat.
Is it almost like a gentrification of the sport a little bit?
Yeah, and the fact, and the word you just used, the sport, it's become way too much of a sport in my mind.
Yeah.
It's not a competition. Hunting is not a competition, not supposed to be. Mm. It's a lifestyle, and that's always been for me, and probably for Christine, but it's really, that subject is really deep and it's really long reaching, and I don't have an answer, but I think in the end the most important thing is for people to want to, and if you want to bad enough, you can probably make it happen. It's not nearly as daunting as it might appear.
Well, that's a great note to end on. Thank you so much, Christine and Steve, for being here this morning. You can listen to this conversation again later at kdll.org. I'm Sabine Pooks. Thanks for tuning in.